So it's a pleasure to be here. And Howard's looking at me. I'm Bob Segi. I'm a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center. And prior to being at Boston Medical Center, Howard and I worked together at Tufts for a long time. So it's really nice to be back here.
No counting,
because I'm 39, so it just doesn't add up somehow. But I also want to say it really is a pleasure, and we're here, and I think that what I want to do in my talk is really emphasize that we're in a sea change in how we view the whole idea of what it is to prevent child maltreatment. So in the Old Bailey Courthouse in London, the lintel says, "Protect the children of the poor and punish the wrongdoer." And that was erected about 100 years ago. And I think we've moved a long way from identifying that maltreatment happens to them, not to us, and that the way to avoid it is to punish the people who do it. And my talk today is really going to be a little bit about those changes in our own social norms in our field. I'm going to talk about that and give some examples of the work we're doing. I want to say that I have no financial conflicts of interest. If anyone would like to develop some, I'll be staying afterwards. And I want to acknowledge my friend and colleague Jeff Lincoln back at the Montana Institute. Some of this talk comes from work we've done together and presented at the Friends Action Network at the Office of Child Abuse and Neglect. My own work here is funded by the Quality Improvement Collaborative for Early Childhood, and in full disclosure, I'm a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of Social Policy in Washington, D.C. So Howard started off today and talked about upstream factors and downstream factors, and everyone in this room is aware that public health, the idea of public health, is not just rescuing someone and picking them out of the river when they're drowning, but going upstream to see why they're drowning and to stop it. But that's not enough. That view is really limited, because upstream is there, downstream is here. It's a very linear model. The world is not so linear. We're now in an age of complex systems. And there are linear elements in a complex system, but if you think about it that way, it's going to limit our thinking. The second thing, if you think about the river in that story, it's all about risk. But why do people go to rivers? People go to rivers because that's where commerce happens, because we like to drink water. Because it's pretty at some level. There are a lot of reasons. So the river isn't only about risk, but it's also about opportunity. And if you only look at something through a risk lens, you'll miss seeing what's really going on. And finally, I think the most destructive thing is that in that story where those innocent people are pushed off into the river waiting for the public health practitioner to plunk them out, the victims are powerless. And I don't think the victims are powerless. I think that a modern public health approach starts and ends in the community and involves the people who are involved in this, not as victims, but as participants and partners. So I like the public health model, but I think we have to really think carefully about what those assumptions are. So, for example, looking at risk factors, many of the maternal, infant, early childhood home visiting programs are targeted at teen mothers. And teen mothers have a high risk of abusing and neglecting their children. But according to NCANS, the National Center for Statistics on Child Abuse. Thank you. less than 5%, actually I looked it up yesterday, 4.7% of all perpetrators of maltreatment are less than 20 years old. Okay? So very high risk group, but if you're in public health point of view, not the main target. Alcohol and drugs go without saying. They're a risk factor, but today there's an election in Boston. One of the candidates for mayor is a recovering alcoholic. So it's not a static thing. And finally, single mothers have been isolated and talked about a great deal. In my practice at Boston Medical Center, a little over half of my families, probably many more than half, are single moms. But they are a whole gamut of people, from people who are totally socially isolated to people who are totally together and have a community and a framework around them. So all of these things, they're not unimportant, but they give you a really limited view. So a more modern view looks at the ecology. So in this picture of the Green River in Utah, you can see that the river itself creates a whole environment around it. So when we're thinking about child maltreatment and about the families and the risks, thinking about the environment is huge. So the 21st century view is that all these families exist in a social ecology. So the primary target of most of our maltreatment prevention work is the family, but that family itself lives in a community, and that community is affected by policy, it's affected by past, it has a different future, and as a pediatrician, what really matters is that inner circle is the baby, because that's who I take care of in my silo. So I think that all of these things, if you don't think about the interplay, you're going to miss the opportunities for prevention. And I think that there's a very clear, and Marilyn did a much better job with a much more sophisticated model. There's a really simple model of maltreatment prevention that links food insecurity, housing insecurity, utilities insecurity, income insecurity, and legal needs to families who live in economic pressure. And these parents, they get stressed, and stress leads to emotional behavior problems. They may have issues among themselves. They may have non-nurturing, harsh parenting. They may abuse and neglect their child, and their children may have behavior problems. So looking at a policy level, what happened on Friday was that we decreased the amount of money the food stamps recipients receive in the United States. The other thing that's happening on a policy level is people who work full-time live in a situation in such poverty that they need food stamps. So if we want to talk about an ecology that will promote or prevent maltreatment, thinking about models like this brings our policy lens on a broader scale, not just identifying families at high risk and teaching them how to be good parents, but thinking about the ecology that they live in and trying to set up circumstances where safe, stable, nurturing relationships are more likely to develop. And that all of these things fit together. The next thing I want to talk about is that there is a lot of risk, but we all go to the river to swim, to send barges down with all kinds of stuff on them to drink. There's a lot of things going on. And at the Center for Study of Social Policy has developed the Strengthening Families Protective Factors. And these protective factors are promotive factors. I think they're changing them from one to the other. These factors are factors that are kind of the flip side of what ACEs are. These are factors that families have that protect their children. So parental resilience. So children are stressful. Resilience is the ability to bounce back from stress. So if you imagine I have an egg and a squash ball, and I drop them both, right? Then the squash ball is quite resilient, and you can't tell that I dropped it. The egg, not so much. So parents, due to their own trauma history, on the one hand, or due to having a strong social network, will have different levels of resilience. Parent knowledge of parenting and child development is key, that if parents interpret the reason their baby cries is because they don't love them, they're going to have a different attitude than parents who think the reason the baby cries is because they're 8 weeks old. And that's what eight-week-old babies do. Concrete support in times of need, I think we've touched. Social connection seems to be incredibly important. And Carl Bell in Chicago has emphasized this is one of the most important predictors, that parents who can't name three adults who can help them with their child, they're in trouble. And then as children get older, the child's ability to form attachment is also very important. So how do you go from research-based premises like the Strengthening Families Protective Factors approach to social norms? I think the best example is a group, the one that I know the best, is Strengthening Family Illinois, and they've summarized this in their Love is Not Enough to Keep Your Family Strong campaign. And what they've done is they've taken these factors, they've focus grouped them, they've talked with people, and they've translated them into language around which you can build social norms. So parental resilience becomes be strong and flexible. Parent knowledge becomes being a great parent is part natural and part learned. Concrete support becomes we all need help sometimes. My clinical practice is half primary care and half child protection. And I would say that one of the things that differentiates the families I meet in my child protection side is those parents say, I don't need any help, I can do it all by myself. Social connection, parents need friends, child's ability to form attachment, and this is really interesting, that became parents can help their children communicate. So this is how one group in Illinois is taking this research-backed framework and beginning to develop a social norms campaign. And I mention that because an effective child maltreatment campaign or effort is going to require a mix of strategies, some at the individual level, some at the family level, some at the school and workplace, and some at the overall community and society level. In my own practice at Boston Medical Center, we've just completed a program called DULCE, which stands for Developmental Understanding and Legal Collaboration for Everyone, which is really a home visiting program in the clinic. And we provide a family specialist who assists families in the first 6 months of life, right in the back room there. And so every time they come to a BMC primary care clinic, the family specialist joins them for all their routine visits. She's also available by phone, by text, by email. She offers home visits. 52.5% of our families wanted and received a home visit. All of that work is centered in the strengthening families approach. And we've just completed a randomized clinical trial, and our results are really encouraging. It's feasible. It didn't take any extra time. Hey, who here has ever been to a doctor's office? Okay, keep your hands up. Come on. Keep your hands up. This is audio participation here. Now, keep your hands up if you've been kept waiting. Okay. So that sounds like a real problem, right? You get really annoyed when you're waiting. Well, 90% of our intervention happens during that period. So we had some bright young MD/MBA students who came to our clinic and did a time study. It's 1 hour and 7 minutes from check-in to check-out on average. Our family specialists spend 1 hour with each family during their visits. So the doctor is there on their study about 18 minutes because we have a very slow practice. But all the rest of the time is plenty of time to do intervention. So it's built in without changing it. Feasibility works. We did everything from improving immunization rate to increasing the resources that our very poor families have. So what was interesting is we asked them a list of about 12 resources, food stamps, WIC, housing vouchers, all kinds of things. And we asked them, have you heard about it? Did you try to get it? And do you have it? And what we found was that at 6 months, when babies were 6 months old, we had a significant increase in the families who were getting those resources. We had no change in heard about it. We had no change in tried to get it. We had a big change in receiving it. Having somebody who can sit with you, if you have limited English language literacy, whatever, and help you get those benefits helps. And this leads into a larger thing, and I see there are two people from our own public health commission here, sitting anonymously in the back there. And Boston and other cities are really looking at place-based initiatives. This one's from Promise Neighborhoods. But this is all to say that if you take a neighborhood where there's a lot going on and try to develop collective impact, and these are the principles from Stanford about what a collective impact is, you set up a neighborhood where the organizations have a common agenda, shared measurement system, their activities are mutually reinforcing, they have continuous and time-consuming and tedious and not very much fun communication, not that I have a feeling about that, and have a backbone support organization, that you can actually make change happen in a neighborhood that you couldn't have otherwise. And this gets to one of the points that I want to end with, is that safe, stable, nurturing relationships result from specific factors. Some of them are psychoeducational factors, but a lot of them are broader. And programs can be implemented with an eye towards changing social norms. And I think the final thing, and the place-based initiatives, I know we're going to hear about it a little bit soon, suggest that solutions can be found in the communities, that it's not a bunch of people like me who work at academic hospitals who make the change. It's really the community that can do it, and we can at best be coaches. If you look at it, the new approach is building these positive factors, whether it's strengthening families' promotive factors, safe, stable, and nurturing relationships, or bright futures. So I'm going to have a modest suggestion, and this comes from my friend Jeff Linkenbach. What we really need is a combined federal effort to promote these policies. Thank you.